This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
And it's a great pleasure for me tonight to introduce our two speakers, Mr. Roy Grieve, who will present his paper on Strafford, on Keynes, on own rates of interest, and Dr. Murray Milgate, who has kindly agreed to respond to the paper. Roy has retired, I was going to say recently, but some years ago, retired from his lectureship at the University of Strathclyde. And he's put his retirement to good use to pursue his research interests, I think, in the areas of history of economic thought and macroeconomic theory. His 2012 article in Rope, which is on the website as the background paper for the seminar, argues that there is a stronger connection between the work of Sraffa and Keynes than is commonly acknowledged even by Luigi Pazzanetti, while recognising the different nature of their projects. And in tonight's paper, he continues this theme to the extent of challenging some recent readings of Sraffa's papers as critical of the substance, if not the exposition. Sorry, of the substance as opposed to the exposition of chapter 17 of Keynes's General Theory. So we're looking forward to hearing the paper. Murray Milgate is one of the leading scholars of classical economics in the tradition of Ricardo and Sraffa. I could mention Marx and Keynes as well, I think. And the lead editor of the journal Contributions to Political Economy. The earliest of his books that I have on my shelf is Capital and Employment from 1982.
I didn't think I was born then, that must be another.
And the latest is The Fall and Rise of Keynesian Economics, published with John Eatwell in 2010. Murray shares the view that Keynes and Sraffa are not incompatible, and I venture to say that he would share my view that post-Keynesian economics would be the poorer for ejecting Sraffa from its tent. Although, as many of us know, there's some work to be done before a full integration, which has proved rather elusive over the last few decades, there's some work to be done before that can be achieved to everyone's satisfaction. But I hope that tonight's seminar actually marks a small but significant further step in the right direction. So,
well,
on that note, Roy, that's your cue.
Or it might. Okay. Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you. Okay. Keynes and Sraffa on own rates of interest, and I have to say I'm indebted to Mark for putting that title on it. In the title, we have Maynard Keynes and Piero Sraffa, Cambridge colleagues and close friends, probably the two greatest economic theorists of the 20th century. And with them, the title, we also have a theoretical concept not often encountered in the literature, but employed by both of them. How are they and it connected? Or more specifically, we ask, did Keynes, while working on the general theory, draw at all on Sraffa's ideas? And if Keynes did take anything from Sraffa, what did he make of it? Can you hear all right?
Yeah.
Good. Yep. So, we can point to three conflicting answers to such questions about Keynes, Sraffa, and the general theory. One, Luigi Pazzanetti, in his quite recent book, Keynes and the Cambridge Keynesians, takes the view that neither Keynes nor Sraffa had any significant effect, any significant influence on the other's work. Second, questioning Pazzanetti's verdict, I concluded that Keynes did in fact draw something important from Sraffa. And thirdly, a third answer to these questions, certain scholars, namely Fabio Ranchetti and Heinz Kurz, claim that critical comments they have discovered in Sraffa's unpublished papers reveal that Keynes, having indeed borrowed from Sraffa, Keynes having borrowed from Sraffa made very poor use of what he had taken. In fact, Ranchetti and Cook describe chapter 17 as no better than an inconsistent muddle. They think it's... I better watch my words here. They think it's rubbish. So this evening I want to focus primarily on the third position, this negative contention that Cain is borrowing from Sraffa brought only confusion and error. And I hope to demonstrate that these critics have completely misread the situation. But before that, it would be useful, I think, to set their position in context by reviewing briefly the alternative positive interpretation, which was my idea really, of what Cain's made of the Sraffian element, which he appears to have taken on board. So, the positive line. So, while I'm not in a position to discuss Passanetti's denial of any Cain's influence on Sraffa's work, I have to say I don't go along with Passanetti's contention that Sraffa had no significant impact on the development of the general theory. Perhaps Passanetti thought own rates, the obvious link to Sraffa, to be no more than exotic red herring. But on the other hand, the argument of chapter 17, albeit expressed in terms of own rates, is anything, in my view at least, but a red herring. In my opinion, Keynes did in fact derive something important from Sraffa. Let me explain. In the treatise, Keynes still subscribed to the conventional productivity and thrift theory of interest. But with the treatise behind him, his thinking quickly moved on. Having discovered the consumption function, he very soon came to understand that changes in income, not changes in rate of interest, constituted the macroeconomic equilibrating mechanism. This left him with a puzzle. Where then did the rate of interest fit in? If it could no longer be seen as the price which equated saving and investment, what was interest and how was it determined? With productivity and thrift abandoned, the rate of interest, as Keynes himself put it, was left in the air. At first, Keynes was unsure how to proceed. He looked initially in a Marshallian direction, considering the possibility of somehow deriving the rate of interest from the return on capital, but came to the conclusion that any such explanation would involve circularity. You weren't going to get anywhere that way. At this opportune moment, when Keynes was really a bit stuck, Sraffa, on Keynes' instigation, produced his famous review of Hayek's Prices and Production. To demolish Hayek's argument that the appropriate strategy for dealing with unemployment was to bring the money rate into line with the unique natural rate, consistent with equilibrium, Sraffa, as is well known, made the point that there exist as many natural rates as commodities in which forward trading takes place. That being so, Hayek's policy recommendation to set the rate of interest on money equal to a unique natural rate was shown not to make any sense. There was no single rate to set it to. My suggestion here is that this Sraffa conception of the existence of a multiplicity of natural, or as Sraffa called them, commodity rates, provided the inspiration which at this point Keynes urgently needed. Thus, in place of the conventional notion of existence but one natural rate, Keynes was brought to recognition of existence of as many natural rates as there are assets. All available assets, including money, are understood to be associated with their own particular natural rates. For these rates, Keynes adopted the designation own rates. In this context, the rate of interest on money now emerges, and note Keynes' significant phrase here, a thing in itself, an asset return distinct from and independent of the yields on other assets. So with money as one asset competing with other assets for place in fund holders' portfolios, returns on all sorts of non-money assets have to be weighed by investors against the liquidity yield on money. The choices that are made, as we know from general theory, directly and indirectly affect aggregate demand, output and employment. In other words, on the basis of an understanding of existence of multiple natural rates, the key idea I suggest that Keynes took from Sraffa, he developed in chapter 17 a theory of asset choice under conditions of uncertainty, a theory fundamental to his analysis of the working of a monetary economy. So seen thus, the importance of the Sraffa influence with respect to the evolution of the general theory, I suggest, can hardly be overstated. So proceeding quickly, going on now to the negative view, currently emerging. So from my perspective, seeing a positive Strathairn legacy in general theory, it was really quite shocking to discover that on the basis of their exploration of hitherto unknown Strathairn papers, scholars are taking the line that Keynes had made a proverbial pig's ear out of what he had evidently derived from Strathairn. Not only was Chapter 17 described as a mess, but it's alleged also that Strathairn himself, although keeping very quiet about it, was of the opinion that Keynes was in that chapter simply talking nonsense. As mentioned, the two scholars alleging that Keynes made a hash of his chapter on the essential properties of interest and money are Ranchetti and Kurtz. Now, very briefly, Ranchetti notes that according to what he calls the Cambridge oral tradition, Strathairn considered the general theory a rather muddled and confused book. Ranchetti reports, Strathairn addresses two main objections to Keynes' theory, and both are radical, if not destructive. Note the word destructive. The first is the idea of a downward sloping liquidity preference schedule, and the second is that Keynes' main conclusion with respect to interest rates is, quote again, self-contradictory. Kurtz is equally uncompromising about the supposed deficiencies of Keynes' analysis. He comments, looking at Strathairn's annotations and Strathairn's own copy of the general theory, one cannot escape the impression that in his judgment the chapter was a mess, confused and confusing. And he elaborates, remarking that the question concerning Keynes' theory is whether his explanation of a lower boundary to the money rate of interest stands up to close examination, answers that, according to Strathairn, it does not. Keynes' argument suffers in particular from neglecting the implications of flexible prices by the value of money on the level of the own rate of money interest. He then goes on to talk about Keynes' failure. And he concludes, this is Kurtz, in Chapter 17, Keynes did not reason correctly and got entangled in a maze of contradictions. His system is logically incoherent. So, two things picked out by the two commentators there. They allege that Strathairn objects, or they say that Strathairn objects to the liquidity preference theory, and also he objects to the asset choice analysis in terms of own rates in Chapter 17. I want to focus on the latter own rates issue for the reason that Chapter 17, I think, is central to the whole of the general theory vision of things. The liquidity preference, or the criticism of the liquidity preference here, are of a secondary nature, I think, that they come under the area, into the area of endogenous money and such issues, which are not incompatible, I think, with Keynes' basic vision. So I want to focus now on the Chapter 17 issues here. How are we doing for time? So the contentious Chapter 17. To assess these conflicting interpretations of the Strathairn general theory connection, we need to turn to Chapter 17, where, so to say, the action is. It is there that Keynes, drawing on Strathairn, introduces his own rates into the discussion, and where, according to the critic, his argument comes off the rails. Now, before we start on Chapter 17, we need to be clear about Strathairn's concept of a commodity rate, which Keynes adopted for his own purposes, rechristening it the own rate of interest. Well, I take it that people here, being of a Keynesian disposition, yes, no, will have a fair idea of the argument of Chapter 17 and of the nature of Strathairn's commodity rates. A simple reminder about commodity rates should, I hope, suffice here. Strathairn presented an example of a cotton spinner selling forward a quantity of cotton. Strathairn describes forward selling, i.e. to say delayed delivery of a commodity, as equivalent to borrowing that commodity. The monetary cost, which might be positive or negative, of so doing depends on the spot and forward prices and on the rate of interest in money. That monetary cost or gain can be translated into a cost or gain in terms of the commodity in question, i.e. can be expressed as a commodity rate of interest by calculating what quantity of the commodity can be bought with the quantity of money representing the gain or loss and relating that quantity of the commodity to the amount traded, the amount of the commodity traded. There's an example in the accompanying notes this sort of stuff. When commodity prices are expected to remain constant, commodity rates will be equal to the money rate. But if commodity prices are expected to change, commodity rates will differ from the money rate, viewing commodity rates as the cost of borrowing higher if the forward price is below the spot price and lower when the forward price exceeds the spot price. Now, this may all seem a bit dry, but the interesting thing here, I think, is there is a potential for confusion in this area, and it seems to me that this potential was, so to say, realised. Use of the adjectives higher or lower in this context points to a possible source of confusion. Any given own rate may be viewed from two alternative perspectives, as the cost of borrowing the commodity or asset in question, or as the yield from possessing that item. So a question of terminology arises. When we compare own rates under different conditions or observe changes taking place in own rates, how do we describe these situations? Are own rates in question reported relatively high or low? Are they perceived as increasing or decreasing? To illustrate, a very simple illustration here. Suppose in a given situation, two own rates involved, money on money and on commodity X. The rate of interest on money is, say, 5%. The price of commodity X is expected to fall, therefore the spot price of X exceeds the forward price. Say these prices, you don't need to worry about the detail, just get the general point here. The forward price, say, £10. The spot price, £10, the forward price, £8. If you work it out, we have here the own rate on that commodity, X, in these circumstances. If you view that as the cost of borrowing the commodity is 25%, whereas the money rate of interest is 5%. So if we're looking at these rates as borrowing costs, the own rate is lower on money than on commodity X, 5% as against 25%. Money 5%, commodity X a much higher cost of borrowing, 25%. But if we look at these, the same numbers from the other perspective in terms of the yield to the asset holder, if you're holding money or holding a commodity, what are you getting? The yield on money is 5%, the liquidity yield to the holder, whereas holding the commodity X, you're losing 25% in depreciation of its value. So that from that perspective, one perspective, the yield, the rate of interest on money is lower. The other perspective, the rate of interest on money is higher than the commodity rate. Which way you look at it, either description is fair, but it depends on your perspective. So what I'm saying is that if we're going to compare own rates, compare their levels, we need to be clear about the angle from which we're viewing the situation. Now, this may all seem a bit peculiar, and no problem would arise, obviously, if all parties involved in debates concerning own rates adopted the same viewpoint, adopted the same convention, whether they treated the own rate or the commodity rate as the cost of borrowing an item or as the yield to the possessor of that item. But these questions do arise. They arise for the reason that in writing about own rates, Keynes and Sraffa adopted different conventions. Sraffa taking commodity own rates as representing the cost of borrowing a commodity, and Keynes, for the most part, treating own rates as corresponding to the yields on holding commodities or assets. So here is a difference of views which can, as I suggest, confuse subsequent interpreters of what is going on. The question is, how do own rates behave as a recession develops? Keynes and Sraffa apparently hold opposite views. Keynes contends that under slump conditions, the returns, he called the own rates, on non-money assets falling, the own rate of money keeps up or declines at a slower rate, forcing rival capital assets out of production. So it's the own rate on money keeping up stays higher than to other rates. By contrast, and apparently contrary to Keynes' prediction, Sraffa states in his notes that if the general level of prices is falling in depression, the money rate will be below other rates. Apparently, a direct contradiction. but I say I emphasize this is an apparent conflict of views. So to see what behind this, my point here, we need to look more closely at what Trapp and Keynes say about commodity rates stroke own rates. Now, in his 1932 paper and in his unpublished notes, Trapper consistently views the commodity own rate of interest as a borrowing cost. He sticks to that all the way through. But let us turn to Keynes. Now, Keynes, unfortunately, does not stick to the one usage. At the beginning of chapter 17, it's clear that he means studying Strafer, and the way he begins echoes what he'd got from Strafer. He says this: "It would seem that for every kind of capital asset there must be an analogue of the rate of interest in money. Thus, for every durable commodity we have a rate of interest in terms of itself, a wheat rate of interest, a copper rate of interest, a house rate of interest, even a steel plant rate of interest. In introducing the idea of an interest rate in commodities, in that way, analogous to the rate of interest in money, and going over an example similar to that given by Strafer in his 1932 paper, Keynes is following Strafer's precedent of treating own rates as costs of borrowing. So far, so good. But Keynes immediately changes his viewpoint without, of course, without saying so, and for the remainder of chapter 17, through which his theory of the working of a monetary economy is developed, treats what he now calls the own rate as measuring the yield on an asset. So he's changed his perspective in the first couple of pages, without telling anyone. Thus, he said... We'll come back to that one. So what he says, the next expression of... is it may seem that the greatest of the own rates of interest, as we may call them, which rules the roost, because the greatest of these rates, the marginal efficiency of a capital asset must attain if to be newly produced. So there's no question now that Keynes has focused from this point on in the chapter, when reference is made to own rates, as in the magnitude of the net gains yielded to their holders by different assets. And the analysis continues in this vein, Keynes developing his distinctive three-attribute story, Q, C, and L, the factors which contribute to the returns on assets. And then using this notation, he says, it follows that the total return expected from the ownership of an asset over a period is equal to its yield minus its carrying cost plus its liquidity premium, i.e. to Q minus C plus L. That is to say, Q minus C plus L is the own rate of interest of any commodity, where these are measured in terms of itself as standard. So he's gone round and looking at things from a different way from where he started, a different perspective from that of Strafer. Strafer, perhaps not surprisingly, took exception to Keynes' treatment of own rates, remarking, this is in his own notes, remarking correctly that in chapter 17, Keynes had put forward three different definitions of own rates, first of which was not consistent with the other two. But it was not only to the variability of Keynes' definitions of his own rates as inconsistent, or to what you might call reverse perspective on them, that irked Strafer. He was particularly unhappy, I think, with Keynes' appropriation of the term own rates to represent returns on assets in general, beyond the short-term context of commodity trading. Referring to Keynes as representative assets and yields, Strafer observed, these, however, are the properties of investments in fixed capital, and it is to its marginal productivity that these arguments ought to refer, or its marge prod, as he put it in his note. We'll have more to say in a moment about Strafer's objection to Keynes' use of the own rate terminology, but for the moment note that Keynes' argument in chapter 17, after the initial bit a la Strafer, amounts, in effect, to discussion in terms of marginal efficiencies. The asset yields, i.e. positive own rates in which Keynes focuses, are in fact the equivalents of marginal efficiencies. The own rate, as Keynes used the term, is the net return to the asset holder as a percentage of the initial cost of the asset. The marginal efficiency correspond to the rate of discount, which equates the net yield on asset to the cost of the asset. So Swafford is saying he should have been talking in terms of marginal efficiency. It actually is, even if he's not calling them marginal efficiencies. And moving on quickly here, we may ask, how did it happen that Keynes took this potentially confusing expositional route, starting chapter 17, by adopting the Swafford concept of the commodity rate as the cost of borrowing a commodity, then for the greater part of chapter 17 conducting the discussion from the opposite perspective in terms of own rates understood as corresponding to asset yields, and eventually, while maintaining that same perspective, as he does after the general theory, I should have said that, talking in terms of marginal efficiencies. Yes, I missed that out. I should have said that after the general theory and further writing as a other work from 1937 onwards, he never mentions own rates. He talks specifically about marginal efficiency all the time. Own rates have disappeared. Perhaps we may speculate about this funny course. I think it's not surprising that Keynes should at least initially express his new conception in the Swaffian terms from which it had evolved. But why change to a different perspective? With the analysis extended from forward trading to a more general account of asset returns, Keynes may have felt it preferable to treat profits derived from investment as instances of positive yields rather than as negative costs, as they would have appeared from the Swafford perspective. So it looks as if Keynes slipped into a different, and indeed for his purpose, a more appropriate usage as the argument of Chapter 17 got underway, though, as I said before, without telling anybody explicitly that this was happening. But treatment of asset choice in terms of own rates did not last beyond the writing of the general theory. So why then did he go in for marginal efficiencies? In the context of long-term investment, the subject of Keynes' concern, and long-term investment chose Keynes' subject, short-run deviations of spot and forward price are essentially beside the point. The expected return on investment depends on factors like productivity and cost, is Q minus C, changing prices, all of which may affect a project over many years, rather than on transient disparities of spot and forward commodity prices. It may well be that with such consideration in mind, Keynes came to think that the conventional terminology was in fact more appropriate in relation to long-term investment and decision-making than the language of forward trading and commodities in terms of which his argument, his conception had evolved. And it might be, authorities on this differ, that Keynes did come to learn of Swafford's disapproval of his usage and adjusted accordingly. But the important point here is that whatever the reason for the changes in terminology, after an introductory illustration of commodity rates presented in Swafford format, all Keynes' subsequent analysis of asset profit and asset choice, whether in terms of own rates or margin efficiencies, focus on asset yields, on return to the asset holder, and not, as with Swafford's usage, on the costs incurred by the borrower. Now this, it is clear, was understood by Swafford in his unpublished notes, but not apparently by the present-day commentators. Am I lagging behind?
You've got about 10 minutes, 15 minutes.
So, Chapter 17, as we know, this discussion of own rates, asset choice, leads directly to the key proposition of the chapter, indeed perhaps the key proposition of the whole theory of employment interest and money, that on account of liquidity preference, the own rate on money, Keynes argues, when own rates in new capital goods are falling, the own rate on money maintaining a higher value with the consequence that as investment projects become progressively less competitive against the attraction of liquidity, the volume of investment diminishes and the economy falls into recession. Circumstances are envisaged with own rates on non-money assets falling so that the liquidity yield on money emerges as the greatest of the own rates, and consequently that rate comes to rule the roost. I maybe curtail this a little bit. Just one quote from Keynes here. Let us suppose that there is some asset, e.g. money, of which the rate of interest is fixed or declines more slowly as output increases than does any other commodity's rate of interest. As output increases, own rates of interest decline to levels at which one asset, after another, falls below the standard of profitable production, until finally one or more own rates of interest remains at a level which is above that of the marginal efficiency of any asset, whatever. And Keynes goes on, of course, to confirm that indeed money, because of its special properties, money is the problematic asset whose own rate can remain at too high a level, driving the economy into recession and deflation. Right, now, the paragraph in Schaffer's unpublished notes, which has got the critics going, reads as follows. They have picked on this paragraph in Schaffer's notes, which appears to say that Schaffer is totally disagrees with Keynes. Now, the paragraph begins with a significant sentence, which the critics, in fact, when they reproduce the paragraph, all omit. I think this, in fact, is the key to the paragraph. What Schaffer says here is that, with reference to Keynes's conclusion about the money rate ruling the roost, he said, what Keynes ought to have spoken of throughout is marginal efficiencies of various articles, not their rates of interest. And then he goes on, if there's one article, marginal efficiency of which never falls below, say, 5%, the reduction of all other durable assets will stop when their stocks are such that the marginal efficiency has come down to that level, and all resources saved will be used for reducing the hoardable asset. If this asset cannot be produced, its demand will increase and can only be met by a continuous rise in its value, i.e. a fall in general prices. If this hoarding is expected to go on steadily and all prices are expected to fall in terms of money, the result will be that all own rates of interest of commodities will be higher than the money rate. This is Fisher's case. The expected appreciation or depreciation is the only cause of divergence in rates of interest. And he concludes, thus, in the Keynes case, the result on rates of interest is opposite to Keynes' conclusion. That's Schaffer's rough notes. Now, as I said, the commentators seem to have neglected the introductory comment that if Keynes had, he ought to have spoken about marginal efficiency. They just missed that out. And they take the passage as implying simply that Schaffer is saying that Keynes' analysis is wrong. Now, what I'm suggesting is that, as I read Schaffer, he is chiding Keynes for talking about own rates rather than marginal efficiencies by showing how the discussion ought to have been presented, but nothing more than that. However, to go back to the critics, this is what they say. Ronchetti evidently thinks Keynes' analysis is wrong. It would have been logical, he says, to refer to the marginal efficiency of different capital goods rather than their own interest rate. However, even if this necessary correction is granted, Keynes' main conclusion that because of the special characteristics of money, the money rate of interest is more reluctant relative to the own rates of interest of other assets would be self-contradictory. And then pressing on here, Coates goes to town on what he takes to be the incompetent character of Keynes' analysis in Chapter 17. As he said, he had a different concept of commodity rate of interest are not compatible. Then, I think just abbreviating to get through this perhaps more quickly, again quoting Coates, Coates makes much of the supposed neglect of the Fisher effect, interpreting that as the source of Keynes' alleged error. Thus he says that with recession, commodity prices will tend to fall. This implies a rise in the value of money. An expected increase in the value of money implies, however, a lower own rate of money interest, to use Keynes's peculiar concept. And then still Coates. Schaffer emphasises, Coates quoting Schaffer, therefore the money rate of interest will be lower than other rates and not higher. Schaffer adds that this is Fisher's effect, which Keynes admits for all commodities except money. Schaffer concludes, thus in Keynes' case, the result in own rates of interest is opposite to Keynes' conclusion. And then Coates returns to the charge. Schaffer argued, amongst other things, that Keynes inconsistently admitted Fisher's effect for all commodities except money. This last objection referred to a situation where, because of depressive tendencies in the economy, money prices will tend to fall. That is, the value of money will rise. However, an expected rise in the value of money implies a lower own rate of money interest and not a higher one, as Keynes had assumed. And in both his 2010 and 2012 papers, Kurt states that in Chapter 17, Keynes did not reason correctly and got entangled in a maze of contradictions. So the whole key argument of Chapter 17 is posh. Well, to try and tie this together, as regards Chapter 17, two issues need to be resolved. To what exactly was Strafford objecting in his unpublished notes? Was it to the substance of Keynes's theory, or only to Keynes's mode of exposition? And second, is there something fundamentally wrong with Keynes's analysis in terms of own rate, the cause of recession, as both Ronchetti and Coates apparently imply? Investigation of the first of these questions should at the same time suggest an answer to the second. Now, what was Strafford unhappy with? Well, there's no doubt that Strafford was unhappy with the way in which Keynes employed the designation own rates in Chapter 17. Strafford maintained that as he understood and defined the concept, the value of that an own rate or commodity rate depended, given the rate on money, solely on the relationship between spot and forward prices. Thus says Strafford, if no changes in price are expected, all commodities will have the same rate of interest, whether it be a delight or a nuisance to possess them. Discrepancies can only be due to expected changes in prices. For Strafford, nothing else had any bearing on commodity rates, yet here was Keynes bringing in considerations of productivity and carrying costs and liquidity associated with various sorts of assets, and giving these factors a role in determining own rates. Strafford took this, I'm saying, as evidence that Keynes had gone off on the wrong tack as regards the nature and role of own rates. Strafford points to the resulting misunderstanding with respect to commodity rates or own rates. And he says this, now it is necessary to emphasise that the advantages involved in holding a commodity have no relation to the own particular rate of interest. Indeed, no properties of that commodity, apart from expected price change, have any relation to the difference between this rate and other rates. For when one borrows, whether money or anything else, as a rule, he does not keep the proceeds but use them to buy the things he wants for production. Even the commodities he buys, as a rule, he consumes productively and does not hold, so that he's not interested in whether they have carrying costs or advantages. It's not terribly grammatical. These are rough notes that Strafford made without polishing them. He comments again, Strafford. Keynes has at the back of his mind two wrong notions which have entirely misled him. These wrong notions are, one, that commodities are borrowed to be kept to the end of the loan, and two, that only durables can be borrowed. As Strafford put it, even fresh fish, his example, can be borrowed, if need be, for 100 years, but not for future consumption, but to be sold forward as the standard in which our debt is fixed. In the context of commodity trading, borrowing an asset need not imply its physical carriage through time by the borrower, as does the acquisition of durable assets for investment purposes. Strafford holds that own rates are properly associated, the concept of own rates for commodity are possible, properly associated only with short-term commodity trading and not with long-term investment in durable capital goods, which is, of course, what Keynes was essentially talking about. He suggested that if Keynes wanted to talk about investment as distinct from forward trading commodities, he should have been dealing with asset returns expressed in terms of the marginal efficiency of these assets. Strafford keeps coming back to this point. For instance, I counted through the sort of about 12 pages of his rough notes, 9 separate instances in which he was saying this, that it should have been MECs, not interest rates, in this phrase. For instance, again, this is literary. This is how Strafford said it. Having sharply distinguished between RI and MEC, he finds that they are not different, makes them all RI instead of recognising all MEC, marginal efficiency. Then again, another note to the same point. Main point, confusion between rates of interest and marginal efficiency to clear up, substitute throughout marginal efficiency for rate of interest. And again, same effect, confusion of the rate of interest and marginal product. In section 2, Keynes tries to build up the rate of interest of each commodity by adding up the advantage and disadvantage of holding that particular article. On page 26, he defines them as the own rate, exclamation mark. The difference between Keynes and Trafford with respect to own rates was more than a matter of just of alternative perspective. Keynes and Trafford's different terminological usage results from a different opinion as to what commodity own rates can properly be taken to mean. Trafford conventionally understands them as indicating the cost of forward trading commodities. Keynes applies the term own rates to asset returns in a much wider context. So Trafford, we could say, objected to Keynes adopting his own purposes, a concept going back a long way, in fact, to Irving Fisher, treating it unconventionally as indicative of a yield rather than a cost, employing it in an appropriate context, and explaining its determination in fundamentally novel terms. In his opinion, Keynes should not unilaterally attach a label associated with a theoretical concept, a significantly different concept. Marginal efficiency was, he believed, the appropriate term to use in the Keynesian context, involving durable capital assets. So, terminology. Keynes should not be talking like that, you see. But final point, if I'm right. What do we make of Trafford's statement, which is highlighted by the critics and it's reproduced in my outline there, that in the Keynesian case, the result on rates of interest is opposite to Keynes' conclusion. As I said, Ronchetti and Coates take this to mean there is a serious problem with Keynes' analysis. But was Trafford criticising Keynes' essential conception? Is there in fact anything fundamentally wrong with the Keynes theory? Well, we need to refer again to this passage. As I said, it begins, what Keynes ought to have spoken of throughout is the marginal efficiency of various articles and not their rates of interest. And then Trafford continues. And I said, I think it's significant that the critics ignore that introductory remark before the rest of the argument starts. So if you ignore that remark, it may not be altogether clear what Trafford is getting at in that passage. But we have discussed Trafford's dissatisfaction with Keynes' use of the term own rates. We're now taking note of that dissatisfaction and the first sentence, interpret Trafford's comment in the light of his, or in light of that dissatisfaction. As we understand him, Trafford is simply making the point that in explaining his thesis that when the state of business confidence is low and wealth holders prefer liquidity to investment in new capital goods, Keynes should have discussed investors' choice amongst assets in terms of marginal efficiency rather than own rates. Now, Trafford's statement begins, you might say, echoing the passage from chapter 17, in which, in the middle of the discussion, Keynes arbitrarily changes from referring to marginal efficiencies to speaking about own rates. And Trafford says he should have conduct a discussion throughout in terms of marginal efficiency. But Keynes begins with marginal efficiency. Thus, as the stock of the asset, which began by having a marginal efficiency at least equal to the rate of interest, has increased, their marginal efficiency tends to fall. Thus, a point will come at which it no longer pays to produce them unless the rate of interest falls pari passu. When there's no asset at which the marginal efficiency reaches the rate of interest, the further production of capital assets will come to a standstill. Well, if Keynes had conducted the rest of this discussion wholly in terms of the marginal efficiency of assets concerned and did not, as he did in the middle of the discussion, switch to talking of the rates of interest on money and other assets, Trafford would certainly, I'm sure, have been happier. Trafford had no problem, I would say, with the first part of Keynes' discussion, because that, in fact, how he begins his own alternative account. If there's one article, the marginal efficiency of which never falls below, say, 5%. But for Trafford, the trouble is that Keynes, in the middle of the story, lapses into his favoured chapter 17 usage, referring to own rates rather than marginal efficiencies. Thus, it is that asset's rate of interest which declines most slowly as the stock of assets in general increases, which eventually knocks out the profitable production of each of the others. As output increases, the own rates of interest decline to levels at which one asset after another falls below the standard profitable production, until finally one or more own rates of interest remain at a level which is above that of the marginal efficiency of any asset whatever. So Keynes switches to own rates, positive returns. Straffer, taking exception to Keynes' presentation, tells the story as it relates to interest rates, as he used the terminology, in what he considers the proper terms. He says, deflation is occurring, a fall in general prices. If this hoarding is expected to go on steadily, and all prices are expected to fall in terms of money, the result will be that all own rates of interest of commodities will be higher than the money rate. That own rates from his perspective. It's the opposite of Keynes' conclusion, own rates from Keynes' perspective, and I think Straffer is simply making the point that in his preferred conventional standard, if you like, consistent usage, that's the way it should be described. So in summary on this, Straffer is pointing out, one, that a conventional explanation of a downturn would run in terms of relative margin efficiencies, that two, with falling prices, the own rates conventionally defined in all commodities would be higher than that in money, and then he goes on to say, in his own words, what would be happening in this scenario in which Keynes says the money rate is the high rate which comes to rule the roost. The substance of the story is the same, only the language is different. Straffer might have said it is the marginal efficiency of money as an asset that rules the roost. And in fact, somewhere in these notes, Straffer actually comments, restate Keynes' theory in terms of marginal productivities instead of rates of interest. So I'm arriving at the conclusion that Straffer says nothing to suggest he has doubts about the validity of Keynes' conception. In fact, he appears to endorse it. What we have here, I think, is a terminological, not a substantive difference between the two theorists. Now, are we... There's a short bit about liquidity that I could...
I think we better leave that.
I'll leave that, and just a concluding paragraph then, to repeat what I was saying, really. My conclusion is that Keynes' Chapter 17 exposition was presented in unorthodox and potentially confusing terms, which indeed appear to have confused the commentators. These are terms with which Straffer was not enamoured. Our investigation has, however, found nothing said either by Straffer himself or by the critics which demonstrates analytical error on Keynes' part. We conclude that the strictures directed by Straffer against Keynes' own rates theorising related to Keynes' chosen mode of exposition rather than, as the critics interpret them, the substance of his theory. I'll leave out a bit of a liquidity preference at the moment. So I'm sorry if I have overshot them. I'll let it be at that.
Thank you very much indeed. So, Murray, to you.
Well, thanks very much, Roy. That's exciting stuff. I want to start with Joan Robinson, who wrote a little paper on own rates of interest in the early 1960s in response to a piece that Nicky Caldor wrote. And commenting on Chapter 17, this chapter that Roy has highlighted, she said this was a very mysterious chapter in the general theory. The chapter contains, as you all know if you've looked at it, sentences with phrases like own rates of interest, own rates of own interest, own rates of money interest, and the like. It goes on. It's a confusing sort of chapter. It's scarcely surprising that Joan Robinson actually found this ungainly. Mysterious and curious it is, ungainly it is, but these sentences turn out to be fundamental to how one might choose to interpret the central message of the general theory. I think Roy's paper is something which I've been through reading it thoroughly, I hope, shows very clearly. There is something pivotal about what's going on in Chapter 17 that leads you to an understanding or a rendering of what you think Keynes is all about. Now, of course, despite the fact that Alvin Hansen thought that this chapter could be deleted without any cost, a view to which, incidentally, I have some sympathy, its presence raises issues not just of interpretive importance, but also of theoretical significance. And so in recounting this story this afternoon, and giving us the story of Schaffer's fragmentary comments on the chapter, Roy's highlighted the significance of the chapter in what I regard as a timely and an engaging kind of way. I think what he's done is focused our attention on something that's quite important. Now, to set the stage quickly for what I hope will be a good discussion, what I thought I'd do is step back a bit from own rates of interest and think about two other questions first. First, the question of what determines the volume of investment. And second, the question, both of these, by the way, are addressed by Ray in the paper itself, although because of the technical side of what he was talking about, he didn't really get around to being able to talk about it in detail. First is, what determines the volume of investment? The second is, will the operation of market forces normally ensure that the volume of investment is sufficient to guarantee that output will reach a level that means involuntary unemployment doesn't exist? These are big questions. These are the two questions that Keynes sets himself in Book 4 of The General Theory, the very book that contains this mysterious chapter on own rates of interest, or what Keynes calls the essential properties of interest and money. Now, Roy actually alluded at this point to something which I think is very important to notice. When Keynes jettisoned what you call the productivity and thrift explanation of interest, i.e., an explanation that planned investment and planned savings are somehow made mutually compatible by variations in the rate of interest, and replaced it with the principle of effective demand, that this job gets done by changes in the level of income, what he did was open up a whole lot of empty, or produce a whole lot of empty boxes. What determines the level of the volume of investment? What determines the rate of interest, etc.? So the reason he's approaching these questions in Book 4 is precisely because he's got some empty boxes to fill, and they're big boxes. So back to those two questions. How might we answer them? Well, I'm tempted to say at this point, according to Keynes, although you'll hear me disagree a little bit with that later, but according to Keynes, two answers. A, the volume of investment is determined by the marginal efficiency of capital and the rate of interest, with that rate of interest, that money rate of interest, being determined by liquidity preference theory. And B, the volume in investment will fall short of its full employment level because of the likelihood that liquidity preference may become absolute, i.e. this kind of shape of a liquidity preference function, at non-zero interest rates. I think this is probably what Roy would say about Keynes's answers to those questions, though I don't want to preempt him saying the opposite. But it's certainly what pretty well every macroeconomic theory textbook says about how we should be interpreting Keynes's answers to those two questions. Now, here's where I want to raise a problem we can discuss. And as usual, it's Joan Robinson who notices it. She says the following. Keynes's conception of liquidity preference was invented to answer the question, why does anyone hold wealth in the form of money, which yields no interest, when interest is offered on other assets? And the answer he gives runs in very short period terms, depending on the state of expectations at a particular time. It does not pretend to answer the question, why is anyone willing to offer interest? By thrusting it, liquidity preference, into a long period situation in which the current and expected demand price for finance have both fallen, Keynes has strained it beyond its powers. In short, we've got an ambiguity, which I think Joan has put her finger on. Nikki put his big finger on it in the article that she talks about when she says this. When you're discussing the volume of investment and how it's determined, this involves adjustment of capacity to demand, physical capacity to demand, rather than variations in the level of capacity utilization. So in that sense, the adjustment or the question of how you determine the volume of investment is a matter for long period analysis, not short period analysis. I think that's what Joan is saying there. So there's a bit of an issue. Of course, there is another issue as well, which you might want to raise at this point in discussion. In filling the boxes we've just presented, Keynes does choose things which are awfully orthodox in feel. So there's an issue about whether he fills the boxes that he opened up with the wrong sort of stuff, but we can leave that aside for now. Back to the problem at hand. Keynes's apparent answer to the two questions seems to involve, for Joan, a certain ambiguity. It's this funny problem of short period, long period. What's the question? How do you answer it? If it's a short period question, you need a short period model to answer it. If it's a long period question, you need a long period model to answer it. You can't mix the two together. This is the ambiguity. And this is where chapter 17 of book 4 comes in, because this is where Keynes outlines, as Roy points out very clearly, an argument which he thinks is capable of underpinning the claim that the volume of investment might normally fall short of its full employment level. Now, Schraffer's notes and fragments on chapter 17, which Roy's presented admirably tonight, although you've got to go and dig through the boxes to make yourself feel that you've really looked at them, right? It seems that Schraffer finds the thing confusing. Now, at this point, you mentioned a Cambridge oral tradition, so I'm going to have a little digression.
Right.
There are certain things in an academic career you never forget, like the job you didn't get or the promotion you didn't get. And in my case, one of those things, since I've got a couple of those up my sleeve as well, is meeting Mr. Schraffer. When I first came to Cambridge in the middle of the 1970s, not long afterwards, I was appointed recorder for a two-day meeting of a secret Cambridge seminar. It was in the Lent term of 1976. It took place in Trinity College. Now, actually, I wasn't appointed recorder. There was no such office, nor was I ever in an official capacity, apart from making the tea. But I was invited to go along and take notes. All of the great Cambridge names of the time were there. Richard Kahn, Joan Robinson, Nicky Caldor, Luigi Pazzanetti, Maria Newty, John Eatwell, Wynne Godley, David Champernowne, and Piero Schraffer, Mr. Schraffer. Now, there was a reception on the first night of this two-day meeting at King's, and I was invited to the reception. I guess the recorder wasn't needed at the dinner. They didn't need to have the tea made, I guess. The beauty of that reception was when I first sat and had a long chat with Mr. Schraffer. He asked me to remind him of my name and what it was I was working on. I'd met him a couple of times before, but only very casually. I duly told him who I was, what I was working on, Keynes's general theory, and the name of my supervisor. Now, he then looked at me with he had these incredibly sharp, piercing, clear eyes, and smiled and said that the general theory was a very confusing book. And he smiled again and wished me well.
Confusing.
So confusing, not confused.
Yes.
Yes. And so the oral tradition, I think, is not ED, but ING.
Yes, yes.
But I can at least give you a bit of that oral tradition. Being recorded, so it's probably worthwhile.
Yes.
Please note, I was recorder at the meeting of the official. Yes, yes. You know.
Thank you. Well, that in fact gives it a slightly different slant from the way it was used in this.
Yeah, let's get back to the... Yeah, I agree with you. Yes. It's different from the slant Ranchetti gives it. Let's get back to the message, though. What did Schraffer have to say about Chapter 17? Why did he find it ambiguous and confusing? Now, I don't propose to go over everything Roy's covered tonight expertly and, I think, engagingly. Instead, I'll attempt to summarise what he's placed before us and then suggest some issues for discussion. I have no idea what the time is, but I'm rushing.
Fine.
If I've understood his argument correctly, he suggested to us that there are essentially three questions that one should ask after ploughing through those boxes of Schraffer's notes and fragments on chapter 17. Is the chapter confusing? Was Keynes wrong to claim that, and I'm now using your words, Roy, mm-hmm. on account, you quoted them as well, on account of liquidity preference, the own rate on money may, when own rates on new capital goods are falling, maintain a relatively higher value, with the consequence that as investment projects become progressively less competitive against the attractions of liquidity, the volume of investment diminishes. Mm-hmm. Straight out of your paper. You read it tonight.
Right.
And three, do the notes reflect a difference of opinion about substantive matters or a difference of opinion about matters of terminology? There, I think, the three things Roy wants us to think about. And as I read him and hear him, I think his answers are yes, no, as long as one agrees that Keynes is talking about marginal efficiencies rather than Schraffer's own rates of interest, and no. So that's his answers to those three questions. And all this leads Roy to maintain a conclusion which I think is his strong conclusion, that is, that the attractiveness of money as a store of value can be responsible for the volume of aggregate demand falling far below that required for full employment.
Right.
Yeah? Now, if Roy had added the word temporally to that last statement, all of this for me would be well and good. That additional qualification, it seems to me, seems to be needed because the economic system, if it's in the position described in that paper, in your paper. It will only be there so long as the prevailing money rate of interest is determined by expectations about its future level. It's going to go somewhere else than where it is. Yeah, that is what Dennis Robertson lyrically called the rate of interest is left hanging by its bootstraps. Not quite right, but that's the way Dennis Robertson saw it. To put it another way, this is a short period problem which would be cured if the money rate of interest were to return to something we might call its normal level. Does this not remind you of endless editorials in the Financial Times these days about what the normal level of the rate of interest is? But we're back to Joan Robinson, it seems to me. There are ambiguities and mysteries here, or these are the ambiguities and mysteries of which we spoke. So what's the big picture? The conundrum we seem to face is whether these kinds of ambiguities, these confusing ways of arguing, and there are other examples of them in the general theory as well as the one Roy's picked out, can be cleared up in any analytically satisfactory way. That, of course, is the million-dollar question. I wish I could answer it. I'd have the $1 million. But there seem to me to be two routes out there that an answer might come from. One would be to regard the short-period solution offered in Chapter 17 as the end of the Keynes story. That is, that tells the story about what's important about the general theory. I think that's Roy's position, actually, but he can correct me if I'm wrong. The second would be to seek to find some long-period solution to the problem of determining the rate of interest and the volume of investment, and then try to retell the story about effective demand with those long-period solutions. Now, million-dollar questions, I can ask them, I can't answer them. But luckily, Keynes gives us some hints in a long-period direction that I think are worth thinking about. If we look first at the money rate of interest, it's not just to liquidity preference that Keynes talks or refers in the general theory, but there's some wonderful passages from my point of view, since it's a pointing in the direction of the long period, about the rate of interest being a conventional phenomenon. And convention is all about long-period things, not psychological things which are subject to short-period variability, as Joan said, subject to expectations of it precisely given at that point. So that's one route. The other route, of course, is on the volume of investment, where Keynes talks about, instead of the marginal efficiency of capital, where Keynes talks about the role of long-period expectations and the state of long-period expectations determining the level of employment. I've got a nice long passage here from the general theory. I'm not going to read it. This is long-period thinking. Now, that's it for an alternative way of doing it. So it may be that the interplay, by the way, between Keynes and Schraffer, or it may not be that the interplay between Keynes and Schraffer was all one way, Schraffer to Keynes. Who can forget the famous remark at the end of production, or not the end, in the middle of production of commodities, where Schraffer says the rate of profit is susceptible to being determined by money rates of interest. Where does that come from? Yeah. I mean, it's straight out of nowhere. It's one you have to think about, right? There could be a two-way street here. And that's all. No, I don't. I want to say one more to conclude, non-technical observations. What is the subject matter of what Roy's told us about tonight? Tell us about these two great Cambridge economists. We know that each was engaged in a project designed to call into question the validity of orthodox thinking. Keynes in the field of output and employment, Schraffer in the field of value and distribution, and to replace it with something better. Right? So they're, in a sense, engaged in parallel projects of a similar kind. But Keynes was a man in a hurry. He's anxious to get things done. He's impatient with what he sees as wrong-headed thinking, sometimes to the point of intolerance. Good Cambridge way of acting. He was anxious to solve practical problems quickly. Schraffer's the very opposite of all of this. He was anxious to get things right. He worked patiently to uncover the flaws in orthodox thinking. He was anxious to solve theoretical questions unambiguously. I think that's what you're describing when you describe what goes on in Keynes's Chapter 17 and what goes on in Schraffer's notes on Chapter 17. You've got the hare running in Chapter 17. You've got the tortoise looking at how he's gone in the background. And I think that's the way to think about the two chapters. You know, which is the best way to pursue economic thinking? Probably a combination of both. But that's all I want to say. I think for bringing this chapter up, Roy deserves our thanks tonight, because it's one of those chapters of the general theory which is pivotal to the rendering we think we want to try and give to something we might call Keynesian economics, that's not to be found in most of the macro textbooks.